Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When you consider all that has already been lost because of the oil spill, wildlife and marshes and livelihoods, it does seem trivial to wonder about the future existence of BP. But the way things are going, oh, it's a fair question to ask. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 1st of June 2010, and it is great to have you here. Shares of BP ended the day down $6.43 in New York, a drop just today of almost 15%. Since the leak in the Gulf of Mexico started 6 weeks ago, the company has lost almost $70 billion in market value, a third of what it was worth mid-April. You put that up against BP's known expenses so far, almost $1 billion in direct cleanup costs to date, and estimates that by the time all is said and done, the company could be looking at $20 billion or more in cleanup and compensation. It does seem fair to ask how or if BP weathers this storm. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
There are some analysts who say this could be a buying opportunity, that BP's stock market plummet is an overreaction.
This is the kind of thing that happens in an environment of considerable uncertainty.
Mark Gilman is an energy analyst at the Benchmark Company. He calls BP's stock excessively discounted, despite spiraling costs to the company from fines, cleanup charges, and a growing number of lawsuits. Pavel Molchanov, an energy analyst at Raymond James, says there's another big negative for BP.
Brand image, industry reputation, how people perceive the company. And just like Exxon was damaged in 1989 for many years, so BP is going to be damaged in terms of its reputation by what's happening right now.
But Exxon still exists. In fact, it's bigger than BP. That could be why some stockbrokers think there's a light at the end of the tunnel for BP and its stock will bounce back. David Kotok, chief investment officer at Cumberland Advisors, is not so optimistic. He says the risk of owning BP stock remains very high.
My estimates are that we will measure the final cost in the tens of billions. If it gets into the catastrophe where it's beyond the five-state region in the Gulf of Mexico, then BP could be gone.
In other words, BP's future may depend on whether the oil ends up being sucked into the so-called loop current. That warm water flow would drag oil around the tip of Florida and could plaster beaches along the eastern seaboard. So far, BP shareholders are hoping that's just a possibility. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Attorney General Eric Holder was down on the Gulf Coast this afternoon. He announced he's opening a criminal investigation into the spill. No specifics yet on companies or individuals that the Justice Department is looking at. Finance ministers from the G20 meet Friday in South Korea. The main agenda item will be the health of the European banking system. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is expected to push for tougher stress tests of European banks and for, eventually, full disclosure of the results. Not likely that he's going to get it, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
The U.S. is worried. European banks are showing the same signs of strain that helped trigger the global recession 2 years ago. They're becoming reluctant to lend to each other. This time, the banks are nervous about which of them is holding dodgy European government bonds. The U.S. wants Europe to stress test its banks in public. Good idea, says Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight.
Most banks actually do most business with each other. And so this kind of uncertainty about who is sitting on problems, needs to be cleared. And the idea of a stress test is to clear this level of uncertainty.
The US did this last year. 19 American banks were subjected to a series of theoretical traumatic events and then required to raise extra capital if necessary. The move helped restore confidence in American banking. But analyst Michael Prest says staging an exercise like that across Europe won't be easy.
There is no single authority, and this is the sort of thing about Europe which always drives Americans mad. You know, the old jibe, you know, who do you call when you want to speak to someone in Europe?
And there's a cultural problem too, says Jan Randolph. Continental Europeans are not always enthusiastic about transparency.
They feel that to reveal too much information about individual banks can actually make the situation worse. So, you know, they've got differing viewpoints in terms of, you know, how much information is necessary.
European officials say they will carry out bank stress tests in their own way. The results should be ready by the fall, but they will not be published. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Hewlett-Packard announced a major restructuring today. And that word, restructuring, is usually code for layoffs. There will be thousands of them. But HP and other major computer companies are actually changing how what they do as well. Janet Babin reports.
HP's automated data centers, those electronic farms that are home to clusters of computers, apparently did their jobs and saved the company money. Unfortunately for some HP employees, those data centers may have worked a little too well. Here's HP Executive Vice President Ann Livermore on a conference call this morning.
HP expects to eliminate roughly 9,000 positions over a multi-year period.
The company also announced plans to hire about 6,000 people in sales and global delivery centers. This type of restructuring has become a pattern at many computer hardware companies like IBM, Oracle, and HP. That's because profit margins on computer manufacturing have become iPad thin.
They're getting a lot of pressure from what's going on over in Asia and other places that there's just not enough money to be made there, and they're not seeing the growth that they need.
That's Joe Colopy. He's CEO of Bronto Software, an email marketing firm. He says some of the layoffs are fallout from HP's acquisition of Electronic Data Systems in 2008. But it also shows how HP has shifted its business model, providing more services and cloud computing. This cloud or internet-based software computing can make companies like HP a lot more efficient.
They're able to have fewer, bigger data centers, which means that they don't need as many people. And also it means that their software cost for running these data centers is going down.
HP officials say the company will save up to $700 million a year. HP also said it will take about $1 billion in charges. Most of that will pay for severance expenses. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Choppy was the word of the day for most of trading on Wall Street today until right at the close when that word became down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Financial crisis is back in the headlines thanks to troubles in some unnamed European countries. So what we're going to do right now is go back a couple of years to our beginnings, when Bear Stearns collapsed and J.P. Morgan snapped it up for basically nothing. Alan Greenberg literally grew up at Bear Stearns. He started as a clerk and retired almost 60 years later as CEO after turning things over to the guy that many, including Greenberg, blame for bringing Bear down, Jimmy Kane. Greenberg's new book about the company and his life there is called The Rise and Fall of Bear Stearns. Mr. Greenberg, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So here we are 2 and a little bit years after Bear Stearns was acquired by J.P. Morgan, what you might call the first stroke in the financial crisis. How are you feeling now about the way things turned out for the whole financial system?
I feel this way. There were originally hundreds of investment banking firms until 60 years after I started, there were 5 investment banking firms left, and we were one of the 5. Not one of those 5 remained intact. So the investment bank that you knew and I knew is gone. It will never come back, in my opinion. It served a marvelous purpose, but in the end, it just didn't work.
Obviously, I'd imagine you regret what happened to Bear Stearns, but do you regret anything you did?
Well, my main regret was the people that worked at Bear Stearns. We had 14,000 fantastic associates, and I was very upset about so many of them losing their job. Kai, you have to understand that I was a very, very small shareholder of Bear Stearns during this period. I owned 15,000 shares of Bear Stearns only. The chairman and CEO at that time owned over 6 million shares. So he didn't want to pay much attention to what I had to say. And no matter how strong I tried to be on certain points, I was totally disregarded. So could I have tried harder? I don't know. Could I have done more? I don't know.
Let me explore that for a minute because, you know, you spent 15 years as the CEO of the place. You were chairman of the executive committee. You have some pull, and that has to be acknowledged. The question then is, where were you and the other members of the board of directors when the folks who were actually executive office holders at the company at the time were doing these things that got Bear into so much trouble? Where was the adult supervision?
Well, in theory, it was in the hands of the CEO and the chief financial officer and the board of directors. I was chairman of the executive committee, that's true. But don't think everything came before the executive committee. In fact, quite a few things did not come before the executive committee. The two funds that got in trouble early on, which I'm sure you're familiar with, neither of those funds came before the executive committee when they were started.
Let's remind folks what those funds were. These were funds that back in the spring and summer of 2007 actually were the first bellwethers of the financial crisis. They went broke.
Yes, that's true. Well, one went broke, and one didn't quite go. But in theory, you're right. I think, really, Kai, the big mistake was that Bear Stearns was highly leveraged, and we were under the impression we owned AAA securities. Because those AAA securities, you know, weren't AAA, in a very short period of time, they went down to 50 or 60 cents on the dollar.
Well, how does that happen, that people who have spent their lives in the securities industry don't know that something that's rated AAA isn't?
Well, when did they find that out? When did AAA securities ever have a drop like they had 2 years ago?
So nobody could have seen this coming then, right?
Well, I'm not going to say nobody, because some people did. Let's just say that the rating agencies had for years put labels on things. The labels seemed to be somewhat realistic. And then, of course, they weren't.
You point out a couple of times in this book that Bear Stearns sort of lost control of its own destiny. Is there something you and the executives of that company could have done that would have prevented what happened with J.P. Morgan?
No. We were lucky that J.P. Morgan wanted to buy our real estate and wanted to buy certain aspects of the business. We were very fortunate.
Alan Greenberg, vice chairman at J.P. Morgan Chase. Now he was for many years the CEO and the chairman of the board at Bear Stearns. His new book is called The Rise and Fall of Bear Stearns. Mr. Greenberg, thanks so much for your time.
Kai, thank you for having me.
Do you ever wonder why the address for the photo sharing website Flickr doesn't have an E in it? It's because, and this is a true story, the founder liked the name Flickr, E-R, but couldn't negotiate the rights to it. The guy who had it wouldn't sell, so she improvised and came up with the next best thing. Cyber squatting, as it's known, has led to a whole spate of oddly spelled company names and web addresses. But Cash Peters found out that the practice of hoarding available domain names may soon become a broken business model.
Choosing a domain name is such a drag. No matter what name you think of, it's already taken. David Sarno's the tech reporter for the LA Times.
If you wanted to go start a beer company, say, forget trying to get beer.com. Somebody probably got that 20 years ago. And then you would try every combination of beer that you can think of, and all those combinations are taken too. So what you're left with is people trying to figure out a nonsense word that nobody has the rights to, and naming their company after that.
Precisely. I hope you're listening. .com. A lot of times, the domain isn't even in use. Some greedy opportunist is just sitting on it, waiting for you to buy it from him at an inflated price. It's sneaky and outrageous. Or to put it another way, capitalism. Because a good domain name is a vital part of your brand, though, this is a real problem. As it happens, I keep branding expert John Tantillo right here on Speed Dial.
It's got to be easy to pronounce. It should be distinctive, It should be able to be translated into a different language, and it should be trademarkable.
He's right. Like IKEA.com or AOL.com. Don't go calling yourself something nobody can spell, like Wachovia, for instance, or Husqvarna. Also, if you can't get your first choice, John says, be prepared to compromise.
You might not get the .com name, but you might get the biz name.
Yeah, but it's so uncool. Nobody wants something .biz.
Coolness is relative and it's temporal. You can't worry about coolness. What you got to worry about is marketing.
Actually, in his case, I'd be more worried about having a stroke. So, okay, I have an idea. Why doesn't someone get off their backside and fix this? You know, just thinking out loud. Well, thankfully, they're about to. Seems there are two ways to do it. Number one, replace this elaborate code we call a domain name with a simple search, like speed dial. David Sarno.
I don't know any of my best friends' phone numbers. That era is gone where you had to memorize phone numbers. Now you just pick out your phone and click on their name. So it should be a similar thing with businesses and entities of all kinds. All I have to do is remember your name, and I search for your name online, and it takes me to your website.
But there's a second way to fix this mess. Extend the number of top-level domain names from your basic .coms and .orgs by adding tons more. Doug Brent is COO of ICANN, the Internet Corporation of... Anyway, they oversee domain names.
In the physical world, when you have beachfront real estate, there just is that limit. There's going to be competition for the beach. It doesn't have to be that way in domain names. Over the next year, perhaps longer, but maybe in that time frame, basically anyone could apply for a top-level domain name. So instead of .com, it could be .mybrand or .mycommunity, like the .inuit community, or perhaps .facebook. The feeling that all the good names are taken doesn't have to be true anymore.
Great, but wait. If you add all these new names, what happens to all those greedy opportunists who basically registered the entire thesaurus to make a fast buck? I do hope they'll be okay and don't lose all their money. I don't know why that's funny, it just is. But really, they're in for a shock.
You're going to have a whole lot of people that have paid a whole lot of money for codes that don't mean anything anymore. And it's going to be replaced, and everybody that paid money for a piece of that system is going to be out of luck.
Oh, darn. In short, the whole system's about to become freer and simpler. In the meantime, though, I guess you grab any name you can. Shame.com is taken, really.
As Frank Sinatra used to say, that's life.
In lacity.org, I'm cashbeaters.com for marketplace.org.
Coming up, this time really was different.
The 1990s was not a happy time, but it didn't have the tremendous problems with foreclosures that we're having this time.
But first, let's do the numbers. Brand new month, same old worries. The Dow Industrials sank 112 points today, slightly more than 1%, closed a mere 24 points above the 10,000 mark. The NASDAQ gave back 34 points, 1.5%, ended up in the terrible twos, 2,222, probably in room 222 as well, I don't know. The S&P 500 sweated off 18 points, nearly 1.75%, finished the trading day at 1,070. That 15% drop in BP's U.S. traded shares I mentioned was matched by a nearly 15% drop in Halliburton stock. ExxonMobil and Chevron shares both lost around 2% today. Big banks lost. Bank of America backtracked 2% today. J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup down more than 2.5% apiece. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for April. The organization American Rivers unveils its annual list of the nation's most endangered rivers. And U.S. Census Bureau Director Robert M. Groves is at the National Press Club to give a status update on the 2010 count. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you're still hoping to score a great deal on airplane tickets for your summer vacation, well, you probably waited too long. And if you have already booked, you can get rid of those thoughts about stretching out on that seat next to you right now. This summer, stronger travel demand is going to run smack into a much smaller airline industry and all the crowded flights that is going to entail. Jeff Horowitz reports.
For ticket buyers, the recession seems to be over. After two down years, the Air Transport Association projects air travel will be up this summer, about 1%. Business travel's been on the rise this spring. But the airline industry has been navigating its own recession for the last decade. Airlines have merged, cut pilots, and parked hundreds of planes. They're not about to reverse course. So, demand is up, supply is not. Bring on the fare hikes.
We're looking at probably coast to coast on the norm, anywhere between 18 to 20% higher than last summer.
Tom Parsons of bestfares.com says travelers face baggage fees that weren't around last summer and new peak travel surcharges to fly on Sundays. The price of jet fuel is also up 20%. Brett Snyder blogs as the Cranky Flyer. He says the usual early summer sales have been scarce.
Bookings are strong. Demand seems to be coming back. So they really haven't had to put that many discounts out there.
Smaller fleets mean domestic flights average 80% full. Flights on popular routes are packed. But Snyder says there's an upside to the industry's diminished capacity.
When you have fewer airplanes in the air that are trying to get in and out of an airport, then it gives you a little more room to wiggle.
Summer on-time performance used to be about 65%. Now it's closer to 85%, says business travel analyst Joe Brancatelli. And if you are delayed, a new federal rule means you can't be stranded on the plane.
It's hot, more expensive, and more crowded. But at least you'll get there faster and won't be hours on the tarmac.
In other words, have a lovely vacation. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
The Obama administration's been trying to do something about the housing market for a year now. Its Home Affordable Modification Program is supposed to help homeowners who can't afford their mortgages and are hard up against foreclosure. Some new rules might help with that. As of today, banks taking mortgage modification applications will actually have to see proof that homeowners are making the salary they say they're making, to see right at the start whether people can afford even a reduced mortgage payment. You'd think they'd have thought of that earlier. This isn't the first time, after all, that real estate has been in trouble in the middle of a lousy economy. Back in the early 1990s, there was no rush to rescue homeowners, and still, nobody was talking global economic catastrophe back then. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has been wondering how come.
It was 1994, and the year's top movie was Forrest Gump. The title character happened to have a line that aptly described those uncertain times for many Americans.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
That was sure true for David Hirschleifer back then. It didn't matter that he was an economist. He hadn't figured on the trouble ahead when he sealed the deal on his Southern California home a few years earlier.
Soon after we bought, of course, prices decided to choose that time to decline.
He was one of many homeowners caught by surprise in the 90s as a deepening recession plagued large pockets of the country. With the Cold War over, Southern California was one of the areas hit hard by the loss of aerospace and defense technology jobs. That left an overbuilt housing supply in the sprawling suburbs, and prices fell, in some cases by tens of thousands of dollars. It couldn't have come at a worse time for Hirschleifer, just when he needed to make a move.
We lost most of our down payment. I don't actually recall our going underwater, but we experienced a substantial loss.
The recession of the 1990s struck other parts of the country, especially metro areas in the Northeast, just as hard. So why has it become only a dim memory for most of us?
The 1990s was not a happy time, but it didn't have the tremendous problems with foreclosures that we're having this time.
Economics professor Ed Lehmer has tracked the housing market for two decades at UCLA's Anderson Forecast Center. He says the national foreclosure rate didn't climb much above 1% through the 90s, so it just wasn't seen as a national problem. And back then, homeowners were better positioned to avoid foreclosure. That was before so many subprime buyers found themselves struggling with funky mortgages, and homeowners hadn't gotten hooked yet on cashing out their equity every few months. So from Boston to Burbank, they just held out for a better price and didn't blink.
Homeowners sitting in their homes can deny, deny, deny. They can say, I'm not going to take a penny less than what I paid for, a penny less than what my neighbor sold. So the result is you get very slow reductions in prices.
In sharp contrast to the willingness or even anxiousness of today's homeowners to take what they can get, which might be adding to the downward pressure, Wellesley College professor Carl Case is a leading expert on the housing market. He points out that back then people wouldn't budge for years.
Now if they hold out, they see all this property being auctioned around them and they get the sense they have to be realistic. There's a sense of, let's get out of here. So it's not just that people are being forced into foreclosure sales, they're walking.
But what kept strapped homeowners from cutting their losses like that during the worst of the 90s?
It was certainly a subject we thought about.
The question wasn't just an academic one for David Hirschleifer, who's now an economics professor at the University of California at Irvine. But it never really went past the debate stage when the value of his Southern California home sank in the 90s.
People were discussing a lot at the lunch table, friends and colleagues at work, fellow economists. What are the costs and benefits of defaulting intentionally on a mortgage?
Very few homeowners broke their word then, but now attitudes have certainly shifted, as Wellesley professor Carl Case sees it. He suggests they've changed right along with the perceived audacity of corporate bigwigs.
You see these big deals and banks getting bailed out, it makes you a little less sympathetic than you'd otherwise be for a bank to whom you have the obligation. People say, if the big guys can do it, why can't I?
The irony is, many of those who are fleeing were new buyers who helped lead us out of the 1990s recession. Now, UCLA's Ed Lemer says their absence is going to make this recovery nothing like the last one.
The reason, I think, is that we have a totally different kind of mortgage market, particularly the subprime market that extended home ownership to the peripheries in terms of geography, but even more importantly in terms of income.
It just fell off at the edges then.
Yeah. So you eliminated a large number of potential buyers. And those homes that are sitting in those peripheral areas, they don't have natural buyers anymore.
If it's true this recession is likely to drag on much longer, there's a hard lesson in making these comparisons. The 90s weren't as bad, but it still took almost a decade for housing prices in the hardest hit areas to fully recover. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, because when all else fails, there is nothing like a good movie to take your mind off your troubles. The Environmental Protection Agency had a meeting in Washington today about how to stop the oil spill. James Cameron was invited. Directing the two highest-grossing films of all time, Titanic, of course, and Avatar, probably did help him get in the door. But Cameron has also become something of an expert in underwater remote vehicle technology, it seems, of which there is plenty of need down in the Gulf. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 112 points, a little more than 1%. The NASDAQ off 34 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 down 18 points. That's almost 1.75%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is what you should listen to tomorrow morning for the earliest and latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, a better way to fix the spill in the Gulf? How about a temporary government takeover of BP, lock, stock, and oil barrel? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.